cities and states are strapped for cash.
So why have they cut back on borrowing money?
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Wednesday, the 9th day of March.
Coming up, why are cocoa prices at the highest levels in three decades? And would you pay $4,500 a day to maintain a house on Long Island? What if it were the house from The Great Gatsby? Mm. Those stories are just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Well, state and city governments often go to the municipal bond market for what are essentially low-cost loans to do big projects such as building bridges and schools. But according to new data from Thomson Reuters, municipal bond issuance is on track for its lowest quarter in more than a decade.
Let's bring in Richard DeKayser, who joins us each Wednesday. He's an economist at the Parthenon Group, and he's with us from Boston. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what's going on now with municipal bonds?
Well, there's a few things going on. Market interest rates have increased. That discourages borrowing. States and local governments are also tightening their belts, and that means less spending and also less borrowing. But the biggest factor almost certainly is the end of a federal program called the Build America Bonds Program. And this was part of the stimulus legislation in 2009, which gave generous incentives both to bond issuers and bond investors. And Cinderella's stagecoach, it expired midnight, December 31st. So a lot of governments front-loaded their borrowing, did so at the final months of last year, and now what we're seeing is the other side of that, which is a dearth of new borrowing.
And Richard, I remember a lot of people saying that if the Build America Bonds program that you talk about went away, which it did on December 31st, that we'd have a disaster in the muni bond market. Is that what's happening right now?
I think calling it a disaster goes a little bit too far. Certainly, it's making things tougher for bond issuers. But the economy's at a different stage of the cycle. We're no longer in the crisis we were 2 years ago. Everyone's having to surrender some of the very generous tax incentives that they had a couple of years ago, and state and local governments are simply one of those constituencies that's going to have to do with a little bit less.
Richard DeKayser, economist at the Parthenon Group, thanks so much as always.
My pleasure.
Well, more people are applying for mortgages than at any time in the past 3 months. That's according to the Mortgage Bankers Association. We hear that tidbit of good news on this day that Democrats are vowing to stop Republicans from defunding federal programs that help troubled mortgage holders. Those programs haven't helped near the number intended.
Well, this afternoon, there's even a Senate hearing on the state of the housing market as a whole. And Marketplace's Gregory Warner is with us this morning to talk about it. Good morning, Gregory.
Good morning, Steve.
So people are applying for more mortgages or they're refinancing. What's that saying?
It has a lot to do with mortgage rates. If you're thinking about buying a house, you want the lowest mortgage rate, but you also don't want to buy too soon before the housing market is bottomed. So last month, mortgage rates ticked up a bit, just over 5%. Partly because the economy improved. So now they're down below 5% for the second straight week, actually at 4.9 this week. So some buyers are thinking, hey, you know, now is the time to jump in and sign on the dotted line and buy a house.
So if people, Gregory, are starting to dip their toes in, is that good news for the housing market?
It is. Some say it's the only good news. There's still a lot of excess housing stock, and home prices in many markets are still declining. I called Susan Wachter. She's a professor at the Wharton School in Philadelphia. She's testifying at today's Senate hearing on the state of the housing market. Actually reached her on the Amtrak on her way to D.C. Huh. Her talk is called Housing Recovery? Question mark.
The question is whether that decline gathers force. If people expect housing prices to decline, they will stay on the sidelines, they will not purchase, and without demand, housing prices will decline.
And that, she says, is really the definition of a very fragile market.
All right. Marketplace's Gregory Warner with us live this morning. Gregory, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Also on Capitol Hill today, a congressional committee looks at whether federal workers are underpaid. Political allegiance usually dictates what people think is the answer to that one. From Washington Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
According to the latest government statistics, the nation's 2 million federal workers are paid, on average, 23% less than similar private sector employees. But James Shirk, a labor scholar at the Heritage Foundation, will tell the committee today the government is missing the bigger picture.
When you include the value of their benefits, the typical federal worker is earning between 30% and 40% more than a similar private sector worker.
Shirk thinks the government should contract out more jobs to private companies where wages and benefits are more competitive. But Max Steyer with the Partnership for Public Service says been there, done that.
Contracting has actually been the largest growth industry of government for quite some time. And there's a real argument about whether we're getting better value.
The head of federal personnel will tell the committee that comparisons between government and private workers can be misleading. Government cooks, for example, may earn more than their colleagues in restaurants, but many government cooks work in prisons, where the working conditions are more hazardous. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Missouri may be the latest state to turn down federal money because of concerns about the deficit. Some GOP lawmakers want to send more than $250 million in federal stimulus money back to Washington. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the story.
Missouri's governor wants to use the stimulus money to extend unemployment benefits and stave off cuts in education funding. But Republican state senators like Will Krause say Missouri should set an example, send the money back, demand that it go toward reducing the federal deficit, and stop using federal money to put off tough budget cuts.
We need to make those tough decisions this year versus putting it down the road.
Other state Republicans say the money would just be rerouted to other states. It wouldn't reduce the deficit. That's what happened when the governor of Florida turned down federal money for a high-speed rail project. Nonetheless, more and more states are refusing some federal funding. Cash-strapped governors are balking at federal grants that require them to chip in or be responsible for cost overruns. Still, most states are not turning away federal money that doesn't come with strings attached. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Sprint and T-Mobile are reportedly talking about a merger. They currently lag behind their larger competitors, AT&T and Verizon. T-Mobile and Sprint stock jumped 4% yesterday on rumors of a merger. So what would all this mean for us cell phone users? Let's bring in Scott Cleland, a telecom analyst with Precursor. Good morning.
Good morning.
So give us the basics. Why would it help these two companies to get together?
Well, there are two big players, AT&T and Verizon, and Sprint and T-Mobile are number three and four. The logic behind this is if you combined T-Mobile and Sprint, they would have more resources in order to provide more to consumers. They'd be able to invest more in their network and be able to get the iPhone and other top products.
Is it all about the iPhone?
I wouldn't say all about the iPhone. I think it's actually about consolidating to have the resources and investment in order to sufficiently compete with AT&T and Verizon.
How would consumers feel a joint Sprint and T-Mobile in the landscape of cell phone service?
Well, I think, long term, they would be getting, more spectrum, they'd be getting more resources. And so I think, consumers of both T-Mobile and Sprint long term would benefit greatly.
What about Verizon and AT&T customers?
They're going to benefit from, a tougher competitor as well. I mean, we have more competition in wireless than almost any country in the world. And some people may look at this and say, is this going to reduce competition? This is a very heavy investment industry, and you have to have the spectrum, and you have to have the infrastructure and the resources to provide a quality service and product. And I think combining makes a ton of sense.
Scott Cleland, a telecom analyst with Precursor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, March 9th. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Now let's get to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world.
President Obama and British Prime Minister David Cameron have agreed to look at a whole host of options in response to the crisis in Libya. Besides any kind of military intervention on the table, the British have drawn up a financial crackdown, which would block Libya and the regime of Muammar Gaddafi from profiting off of any oil sales. From London, here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
The world has already tightened the screw on Gaddafi's personal finances. Many of his assets and those of his family and cronies have been frozen. But the country is still producing some oil, and analysts reckon the regime is still making at least $150 million a week selling it on the world market. Now the Brits are urging the United Nations to stop this flow, to divert the cash into a special account. The account would be run by the UN on behalf of the Libyan people. Speaking in Parliament, Foreign Secretary William Hague spelt out the benefit of such a plan.
to reduce the financial flows to the Gaddafi regime, which of course may be used to support the level of violence and attempts to suppress the protests.
Yesterday, the European Union stepped up the financial pressure on Gaddafi. It imposed sanctions on the country's main investment arm, with assets worth $70 billion. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The price of cocoa today is near a three-decade high, and that means chocolate's about to get more expensive. A possible civil war in Ivory Coast has its former leader fighting to hold on to power after losing an election last year. One tactic he's using is exerting more control over the nation's billion-dollar cocoa industry.
The BBC's John James is with us from Abidjan with an update. Hi, John.
Hi there.
The Ivory Coast today says it's going to buy these cocoa beans at a fixed price from farmers and then sell them on the world market. Is this the nationalization of cocoa?
Yes, I mean, this is a country where cocoa is by far and away the most important industry. And in terms of world production, this is where more than a third of the world's cocoa come from. Because of the political crisis here, beans aren't being exported because of a boycott and because of sanctions on the ports as well. So, yes, the government's trying to take control of production, only they'll have the right to buy beans at the farms and then exporting them themselves to try and get some of that revenue back.
Now, John, cocoa prices are at a 30-year high. Does this mean it's going to be more expensive chocolate for the rest of us around the world?
There's probably a good chance that will happen because, as you say, cocoa prices are high, and that's because of the problems here in Ivory Coast. And the problems don't seem to be on the way to being resolved anytime soon. So I'm sure chocolate manufacturers will have to pass on those high prices for what is the essential ingredient in chocolate onto the consumers.
The BBC's John James in Ivory Coast. John, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, next week, the Supreme Court in Bangladesh will decide whether to let a Nobel Peace Prize winner keep his job. Muhammad Yunus is known as the godfather of microfinance for giving small loans to the poor.
His idea has helped millions of people work their way out of poverty, but Yunus himself was fired from his position last month because he's passed the country's mandatory retirement age and has put a big question mark over the future of the microcredit model he created. The BBC's Anbarasan Atirajan has more now from the capital, Dhaka.
Professor Yunus has taken his fight to the Supreme Court in Bangladesh, claiming the government is trying to take control of his Grameen Bank. Debapriya Bhattacharya is an economist at the Center for Policy Dialogue in Dhaka, and he says the sudden departure of Yunus from the bank could impact its stability.
So it is going to affect the overall efficiency, efficacy of the poverty alleviation efforts.
Meanwhile, the microcredit industry itself is under scrutiny. A number of for-profit microfinance institutions have mushroomed in the last few years, charging very high interest rates and using coercive debt collection methods. The companies claim competition will eventually drive interest rates down. But analysts warn the negative perceptions could ruin the sector. In Dhaka, I'm the BBC's Anbarasan Atirajan for Marketplace.
Steve, I've got a deal for you.
Please.
It's a 1902 mansion set on 13 acres in beautiful Sands Point, Long Island.
That sounds very nice.
And unless you buy it, it's going to be torn down at the end of the month. It's available for the low, low price of $30 million. Now, the maintenance costs are high. They're around $4,500 a day. But get this. The house was the inspiration for Daisy Buchanan's house in The Great Gatsby. It was the one with the green light at the
green
end of the dock.
Light. That's right.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, the 9th day of March. I'm Steve Chiotakis on Twitter, by the way, at Radio Chio.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson. You can also go to marketplace.org and give us your feedback by clicking on the link that says Contact. Well, Steve, have you heard of the term green chemistry?
No.
Well, it's been around for a couple of decades, and it's all about making the stuff we use every day less toxic and less wasteful. Now, as Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports from the Sustainability Desk, one of Green Chemistry's founders is out to prove you can make money with it, too.
John Warner was a top industrial chemist when his 2-year-old son died from a rare birth defect.
Lying awake at night, the evening of my son's funeral, staring at the ceiling, asking myself, what if something I touched caused my son's disease? What if something that I got an award for ultimately caused my son's death?
Warner and his friend Paul Anastas developed green chemistry in the 90s. Their idea was that industrial processes don't have to be bad for humans and the environment. They could be benign by design, so to speak. Warner preached that gospel for years as a chemistry professor. Now he's trying to prove green chemistry can work in the real world.
And so in this lab over here, we have people working on large object ceramics.
Ceramics as in bathroom fixtures. Warner now heads a small startup company north of Boston called the Warner Babcock Institute. It helps its clients, from drug companies to cosmetic firms, by coming up with non-toxic, more energy-efficient, and less wasteful ways to make their products. And those clients want to save money by doing it. Warner says that's possible. After all, toxicity carries a pretty high price tag.
Look at the amount of money we spend in hazardous waste. Look at the amount of money in storage. Look at the money in transport. If you have a hazardous material, it just costs so much money.
Warner doesn't divulge his client list or revenues, but says the company has worked with 18 clients so far and is cash positive. Among their successes, reducing the amount of chemical waste from making a Parkinson's disease drug and figuring out a way to use less energy in making solar panels. Oh, and there's the hair dye that's less toxic. A now brown-haired Warner says he's been the lab guinea pig on that one.
This is a chemistry experiment. This isn't a product yet, but, you know, obviously, it's on my head.
In Wilmington, Massachusetts, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Libyan violence, high gas prices, climate change. And yet these days, Jeremy, it's hard to shake Mark Stevenson of his rose-colored glasses. He's got a new book that's just out. And the author takes the challenging subject of a future wrought with problems and makes those problems seem a bit more palatable. Stevenson wrote the book, The Optimist's Tour of the Future, and he's with us right now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, with the threats all around us, disease and climate change and just overall bad people, why are you such an optimist?
I'm not saying the future will definitely be better, but what I am doing is putting a few of those good options back on the table, because we tend to sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater. So the book is actually quite well balanced, but it's balanced in the fact that it covers all the good stuff as well, which we don't get to hear enough about.
Well, I want to focus on the bad things, since you're the optimist here. There's so much doom and gloom out there, especially about climate change, that the planet is changing. How can we be optimistic about it?
Well, the climate change argument is something we do need to be very worried about. But there are a number of things we can do now to solve that problem. Just one example is a man based out of Columbia University called Klaus Lackner. And he's invented a machine that can scrub carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere very cheaply. And he just needs $20 million to turn his prototype into a manufacturable unit. And 100 million of those would solve the problem. That sounds like a lot of technology, but you have to remember that we make 73 million cars every year.
How do we harness the best of what society will have to offer and use it as opportunity? I mean, is it only a matter of good timing, or how did people prepare for this?
When we talk about innovation, we talk very much about what's happening in medicine or technology or even, you know, fashion, dance and music. These areas where we're used to talking about rapid innovation. But the one place that doesn't seem to innovate very quickly is government. The way that government operates really hasn't changed much for 300 years. And so it's very hard for them to keep pace with the change that is happening elsewhere, which means that you have this disconnect between legislation and technology, and that can be dangerous. So I think what we really need to do is re-architect the way some of our institutions work to more rapidly innovate in the way they deal with information.
What do you say to pessimists?
For me, it's about making sure that you aim in the right direction, saying, look, we still have faith now in our ability to make things better, but let's use our critical thinking skills and our intellect to make sure we do that with evidence rather than emotion.
Mark Stevenson, author of An Optimist's Tour of the Future. Mark, thanks.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And finally, police officers on Monday, Jeremy, spent a couple of hours picking up tens of thousands of dollars along a busy highway north of Columbus,
wow.
Ohio.
Wow.
Yes. Was it an armored truck that spilled this load of cash onto the road? No. Was it maybe some sort of bank car, or maybe the FBI was transporting money? No, none of that stuff. They have no idea where this money came from. I, however, know what happened. Somebody probably just left the money they were going to pay for gas on the top of their car, and it just flew right off of there.
You know, thousands I would just like for once in my life, Steve, to be the person on the highway that finds the thousands of dollars in cash.
You want to be the first one there.
I want to be the first one on the scene. Yeah. I'm just going to keep driving like through Beverly Hills.
Beverly Hills, because that's where the money is.
Right.
People were this is Highway 23 north of, as I said, Columbus, Ohio, and people were saying that money was just floating past them. Like they were driving their dollar bill or whatever dollar denomination it was, floating right past them, and they called the cops.
Well, heading for the freeways now in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.